Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
They aren't new inventions that are necessary. It's simply organizing and creating the political will to win those reforms at the same time that we are increasing people's confidence in the fact that we actually know how to run a system. We don't need capitalism anymore. In the end, we don't need it anymore because it doesn't serve our interests as well as a participatory, democratic, socialist economy would.
That's the voice of economist Dr. Robin Hanel. In this week's show, we speak to Dr. Hanel about minimum basic income and many ways forward regarding the economy. So stay tuned.
You are listening to Latin Waves. I'm your host, Sylvia Richardson. I'm very privileged this morning to be joined by Dr. Robin Hanel. He's a professor emeritus from American University in Washington, where he has taught for over 30 years. He's most known for his prolific writing. Some of his co-creations have been with author Michael Albert on the alternatives to capitalism. He's also worked with Aaron Olin Wright. And I'm very privileged today to be talking about his book, his latest book with Eric Olin Wright, Alternatives to Capitalism. Welcome to our show, Robin.
Good to be with you, Sylvia.
Now, in previous interviews, we have talked about an economics of the people. So your book was Of the People, By the People, The Case for a Participatory Economy. And now we are, I think, at the stage where we really want to describe what the elephant in the room is, and is that capitalism isn't working. So what is an alternative to capitalism? Many people are talking about universal basic income. Perhaps there is an idea of a complete socialism. What are we talking about?
I mean, I think it's important for people to realize there's two different questions. One is capitalism with a different economic system. If we really expect to solve our economic problems, if we really expect to achieve economic justice, economic democracy, environmental sustainability, et cetera. And I've long argued, along with many, many socialists for many, many years, that we eventually need to replace capitalism with some form of participatory, ecologically sound socialism. But that's a way in the future. And in the present, we need to search for programs that will improve outcomes and also move us in the direction of eventually replacing capitalism with a far better economic system. And one of the new ideas that the left and progressives have, you know, are discussing in not only the United States, Canada, but in Europe as well, is something called a universal basic income. And this is a very interesting idea. It shouldn't be confused with replacing capitalism with socialism. It is what I would call an economic reform that, if done well, would improve outcomes. It would essentially make outcomes somewhat more equitable within capitalism. So in that context, it needs to be sort of analyzed or compared with other strategies for improving, you know, income distribution in capitalism. Ones that we've talked about and the left has worked for in the past, such as organizing unions, which will win better wages, or such as living wage campaigns that are local, or such as campaigns for raising, you know, the national minimum wage. So people should understand that universal basic income is a different policy than the ones I just mentioned, but it's aimed at the same thing, which is doing something in the here and now that's effective about stemming the escalating inequality that neoliberal capitalism has unleashed.
I think that it's really important to talk about what an economy is and what it is supposed to do, because the reason it's so naturalized that the only way we can create an economy is capitalism is because most people don't understand what exactly the economy is.
For most people, there is no alternative to capitalism. They think capitalism is what economics is. That's one of the things we struggle against. And then a second problem that eventually has to be overcome is anybody who thinks there might be an alternative to capitalism, they assume it was 20th century Soviet socialism. And that's not what any of us, you know, are proposing anymore. But a universal basic income is, it's a policy that ordinary people can understand, and it's really quite simple. It says that the government will give every member of society a certain income, no questions asked. It simply comes with a monthly check, or it can come at the beginning of the year. I'll describe one proposal because it's easier to understand that way. So we could have a universal basic income in the United States where every adult over the age of 18 gets $1,000 a month, and every child under the age of 18 gets $500 a month. That would be for, I hesitate to call it a tip. We used to call this a typical family of four. And of course, there are fewer and fewer typical families. But two adults and two children, you know, that would be an income that would be $3,000 a month. And that would be $36,000 a year. Now, that's about 150% of the poverty income for a family of four in the United States. So that would mean that that income that comes, no questions asked, to absolutely everybody would put everybody above the poverty line, considerably above what's called the poverty line. Well, that's a huge benefit in terms of combating poverty. It's also a huge improvement in terms of income distribution. Now, the question comes, well, where does all this money come from? Because that is roughly 20% of gross domestic product. Where is that going to come from? Well, you're going to have to, essentially, you have to raise that amount of money in taxes. How could you do it? Well, it turns out you could raise it in the following way, which would be a good way to do it. Don't raise anybody's taxes who is above the median income. So the bottom 50% of the population, you don't raise taxes from them one iota to pay for this. Only people above the top half would have their taxes go up. Now, everybody above the top half would have their taxes go up. If you do it in a progressive way, and if you also taxed 2% of wealth for the top 1% of wealth earners, it turns out that the bottom 50% have no increase in taxes. The next 40% from the middle up toward the top, they would get more in the universal basic income than their taxes would rise. So they would be better off. And only the top 20% and the top 1% of wealth earners would have taxes that were larger than the universal basic income they were receiving. That would be a wonderful policy. So would unionizing the entire workforce. So would raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. So the question is this a better thing to fight for? Is it more politically feasible? And those are the things that people are discussing at this point.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, because I just heard a report recently that the top 1%, mainly inheritance money, you know, it's not something they're producing. It's not some, an item that some kind of contribution that they're making that goes. Simply you inherit it. You were born with it and now you have this money. So can we talk about this, how this taxation would then sprinkle? Because what we're hearing instead is the idea of a flat tax, the idea of increasing taxes that, you know, it seems like they would be a better choice because they're lower in taxes. But what's the difference between a flat tax and one that taxes, for instance, the inheritance of that 1%?
You know, in Canada, I think you're a little, I think the populace is a little more sensible about taxation in Canada than it is in the United States. I don't think there's any country on the planet where the population is more confused and engages in more self-inflicted wounds in terms of how they vote and respond to the word tax. A flat tax, as it's commonly used, is everybody pays the same percentage of their income in taxes. So if you earn $20,000 a year, you pay 10% of that in taxes. If you earn $2 million a year, you pay 10% of that in taxes. That's what people call a flat tax. It's basically, an economist would more carefully describe it as a proportional tax. Everybody pays the same proportion of their income, in my example, 10%, in taxes. One reaction to that is, well, that's remarkably fair. I mean, everybody's paying the same proportion. On the other hand, it's not remarkably fair if the original distribution of income was unfair in the first place. If the people in the top end, if they deserve less of their millions of dollars of income than people in the bottom end, then proportional taxation simply recreates whatever economic injustice was there in the first place. So if you want a tax system that will at least ameliorate the economic injustice that the labor and capital market create when they distribute income in the first place, then the tax system has to be what's called progressive. You have to take a higher percentage of high-income people's taxes and a lower percentage of low-income people's taxes. So that's what's at stake. Anybody who's a progressive, who's fighting for progressive ways to ameliorate escalating income inequality, we need to fight for progressive taxes rather than flat taxes or proportional taxes. And we need to identify all the taxes that are actually existing, which are actually regressive. They end up taking a higher percentage of low-income people's incomes than they take of high-income people's incomes. And the principal tax that does that is a sales tax. Sales taxes are notoriously regressive. They actually take a higher percentage of low-income people's income than they do high-income people's income.
What prevents us from creating this basic universal income project, and you know, that clearly will lift people? Because in the past we've told every high tide lifts all boats, but as Noam Chomsky says, you know, some high tides sink boats, right? And a lot of these high income waves have only benefited very few people. So what's preventing us from creating this now?
Well, okay. I mean, the debate that goes on over a UBI, one is a question of practicality, which is, if we prioritize a fight for a UBI and we put our time, energy, and political clout into a campaign for that, are we likely to be more successful than if we try and pour time, an equal amount of time and energy into union organizing or into fighting for raising the minimum wage? The UBI, I mean, it's not a miracle cure. It's just one way to reduce economic injustice in capitalism. I mean, the other thing we could do is we could fight harder to better and more adequately fund our present poverty programs. So why is it that people are talking about this instead of talking about all sorts of other things that we used to do to try and address both poverty and income inequality? And I think the answer to that is, well, there's been a change in circumstances. Unions are incredibly weak. What if they continue to be incredibly weak? Well, 10 years ago, progressives started working on some rather successful local campaigns for living wages. In metropolitan areas where there was a progressive voting population and you could affect city governments, then you would try and pass living wage ordinances. And we did that successfully. Well, why did we do that instead of fighting to raise the national minimum wage? Well, because we didn't have enough political clout in Congress to do that. So this should simply be viewed as
in present political circumstances, are we more likely to make headway and progress trying to fight for a UBI than some of the old things we did? And I don't know if the answer to that is yes or no. One thing to consider is this, and this has come up in the past also. There's a difference between a universal basic income and a basic income. Universal basic income means you give everybody, every adult over 18, for example, $1,000. Well, wait a minute. That means you give the millionaires an extra $1,000. That's what universal means. Oh, well, why would we do that? Why wouldn't we just give people who need it this basic income? Well, that's a basic income, and it's different from a universal basic income. And there's an argument for doing that. It's the same as the argument for giving people who don't need Social Security when they retire Social Security, and that is you get more political support if it's universal. On the other hand, you have to, the taxes you have to raise to pay the extra money to the people who don't need it because you made a basic income universal, that means you do have to raise the extra taxes to give the wealthy their $1,000 a month. So this is something that's discussed amongst people. Do you want it to really just be a basic income for people who need it, or do you want it to be a universal basic income? The other thing that I think is very important for progressives to think about is whether or not this would be resented. Suppose you're hardworking. Both adults in the family are working at low-income jobs. They're barely making it. Now, they get their universal basic income, but so do people who aren't working at all. And are you going to have resentment on the part of the hardworking poor that people who are not, in their view, hardworking, but could be or should be, are getting this basic income also? And I'm quite concerned with that. That's a political issue that progressives do need to think seriously about.
You're listening to an interview with Dr. Robin Hinnell on Latin Waves. For more information on Latin Waves or to hear previous episodes, go to www.latinwavesmedia.com. And now back to our interview with Dr. Robin Hinnell.
I want to intercede there because as long as we have an economy that relies on markets and relies on a divergence of income stratas, right? So as long as we have an economically poor sector of the population, you are going to have unemployment, and that's the reality. So I don't think the resentment argument is that hard to overcome, because literally if we had zero employment, then you could argue that, you know, everyone could potentially have a useful job. But many of the people who have the highest gross income, and I mean gross in every sense of the word, do not make anything. You know, they inherited that money. They're sitting on money that they never work or will work for. So I don't think that argument is a very hard one to overcome. What I do think we need to talk about is the point you made earlier about the strength of a union. Because unions not only ensure that people have livable wages, you know, jobs with dignity and justice, I would say activate our sense of empathy and care for one another. It's about safety. It's about dignity. It's about wages. It's about, you know, the health of the entire community. So can we talk a little bit about the process that having a universal basic income would create and how it would allow us to have more space, more time to organize, to co-create this vision of a more just society?
I think you're focusing on important things that progressives need to weigh. On the one hand, and everything you said, I think is completely correct. What unions say is our people are doing hard, they are making sacrifices to do socially useful things. And they deserve to be rewarded for those sacrifices that they are making, because sacrifices are necessary if we're to have useful things, useful goods and services. A universal basic income says, basically, our society is wealthy enough, all of us together, when we work, are wealthy enough so that we can afford to give everybody at least this much. We no longer have to have anybody living in poverty. Now, in some sense, I think that's a very good message. We are collectively wealthy enough. Our technology and resources and productive economic capabilities and advanced economies have reached the point where there is no reason anybody should live in poverty. That's a positive message. On the other hand, if you're hardworking, how do you feel about people who choose not to, if you believe that's what they would do, and still have this basic income? So that resentment factor, I think, is a problem. The whole idea that there is dignity in doing socially useful work, which is essentially the union message, I don't think that is a message that comes from universal basic income. It's, well, as citizens in a wealthy economy, we have a right not to live in poverty. We have a right to live 150% above the poverty line. That's essentially what the universal basic income I described. I mean, there are all sorts of other problems with universal basic income, which is the one I described would be well worth winning. Well, if it turns out that what you're going to get is something that is a cheap version of universal basic income, and you only get it because you politically concede that you are no longer going to have a whole bunch of welfare programs, well, then you could end up worse off than you started. You could essentially have been tricked into fighting for a reform that it wasn't a generous one. It wasn't financed through progressive taxations. It still leaves people below poverty lines. And in fact, it was used as an excuse to get rid of all sorts of other anti-poverty programs that we've had in the past that the right wing is always trying to convince us to eliminate. So those are just a host of practical situations. My own attitude toward the universal basic income is I understand why people are looking for a new tool. They need to understand what this tool is and what its pros and cons are. In the end, you have to decide, are we going to make more progress toward our end of reducing income inequality this way, as opposed to other ways that we have at our disposal?
Can you say more about how this tool can be used against us to eradicate social systems? Like, would this mean because we get a universal basic income, you no longer get funded healthcare, you no longer get funded housing projects? Is that what you're talking about?
That's exactly what I'm talking about. And it would be very foolish for us not to understand that that would be the nature of the political battle that we would be fighting if we put time and energy into fighting for a universal basic income. In the end, what we win is always a question of our political power compared to our opponents. Just because we decide to fight for universal basic income, I mean, we fight for unionization. We've been losing. We could fight for universal basic income, and we could lose in that fight as well, if we didn't increase our overall power, you know, in terms of our opponents.
Whether we see this challenges ahead, it's important that we go with clear eyes. And I think that what you're saying is very wise. You know, we want to fight for tools that allow us to lift people out of poverty. We want to create tools that create a more democratic redistribution of wealth that is co-created by people's labor and, you know, sacrifices. And we want to create a world where we are also offering other forms of contribution, where art, where music, where activities, people who help people stay healthy and active are also valued as worthy, you know, work to be completed. So in many ways, I think we're fighting not just for the right to have work that pays us with dignity, but also for the right to envision a society without injustice, without inequality. And I think that's really where we're going. So as we move closer to the end of our interview, I wonder if you could tell me what inspires you these days. I know you've been very active with some movements, the Job with Justice movement and Rising Tide. Can you talk a little bit about what inspires you and, you know, and makes you believe we can do this? We can. After all, you did write the book. Participatory democratic economic systems do exist in your imagination and in practice. They already exist.
My overall view is that, first, human beings are perfectly capable of managing and running an economy that is far superior to any version of capitalism. That is increasingly apparent the more we see how capitalism works and the more we understand what a, you know, how it is that a participatory system of planning and taking environmental consequences into account is well within humanity's grasp. At the same time, this isn't going to happen overnight. The other thing that's increasingly apparent is that there are better and worse forms of capitalism, that neoliberal capitalism is much, much worse than what we used to in the 20th century call social democratic capitalism. So we know that capitalism with strong unions that represent a majority of employees is a much better economy than capitalism in which unions have been, you know, eviscerated, which is literally what's happened in the United States. We know that capitalism that has welfare programs for people who, through no fault of their own, fall between the cracks in the competitions, in the economics of competition and greed, is a far better form of capitalism. What we're talking about now is, well, what are those programs that we could use now in the here and now to diminish the damage that neoliberal capitalism is unleashing on the planet and the entire bottom half of the income distribution? What can we do in the here and now? And there are tools, and a universal basic income is one, unionization is one, minimum wages is one, welfare programs is one, financial regulation is one. All of these things they're not rocket science. They aren't new inventions that are necessary. It's simply organizing and creating the political will to win those reforms at the same time that we are increasing people's confidence in the fact that we actually know how to run a system. We don't need capitalism anymore. In the end, we don't need it anymore because it doesn't serve our interests as well as a participatory, democratic, socialist economy would. Those are two different battles we have to be waging. We've been losing both. We have to wage them at the same time. You don't have to do one rather than the other. I think we have to do them simultaneously, and the coming generation has to be more successful than, unfortunately, my generation was.
Thank you so much for that. You are a wonderful economist and one that speaks to my heart. I think a society that is well-informed is a society that is stronger for it.
Well, thank you again, Sylvia, and I'm sure we'll talk again in the near future.
Take care. Thanks again.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.